This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. It's not every day that an author writes his first novel after winning 5 literary prizes, but Anthony Mara has done just that. And reviewer Meg Wolitzer says the book lived up to all her expectations.
Some of the best writing advice I ever got was from an editor who told me that a reader needs to want to go there. What he meant is that you should make the world of your story inviting. It needs to be a place where readers want to linger. I was thinking about that as I was reading Anthony Mara's amazing book, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. The story takes place in Chechnya. It's full of hopelessness and torture and war and landmines. The thing is, I did want to go there. The book is so good, the writing and the characters are so compelling, I stayed in it. Listen to this first sentence. On the morning after the feds burned down her house and took her father, Hava woke from dreams of sea anemones. Hava is this incredibly bright little girl living in the most unlivable circumstances. The feds have cut off her father's fingers during an interrogation. Now they're back to take him in the middle of the night. Hava hides, but it's clear they want to take her too. So her neighbor, Ahmed, brings her to the city hospital, hoping she'll be taken in. That's pretty much the plot. The novel belongs mostly to Ahmed, the neighbor, and also to Sonia, the one doctor still working at the almost entirely equipment-free hospital. When I started this book, I kept nervously trying to rely on Wikipedia. I thought if I understood the complex history of the region, if I was fortified by the details of the First and Second Chechen Wars, if I knew the role of Stalin at the root of all this, I would be prepared. As if. Nothing could have prepared me for what happens in this book's broken landscape. But that's okay. I realized it's better to come to it as a naked reader in the wilderness of the novel. And you should, too. Trust this writer, because he's created such an accomplished and affecting book. It's not perfect. Every once in a while, you can feel Mara trying a little too hard to tie loose ends together. And I don't blame him. The material he's working with really defies order and reason. But he doesn't need to try so hard. The lives lived in this novel can seem unbearable, but Anthony Mara has described them in such passionate, extraordinary prose that they become not only writable, but also highly, deeply readable.
The book is A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. Our reviewer is Meg Wolitzer. Her most recent novel is The Interestings.
Okay, this time of year, many high school seniors are thinking about what's next. Some aren't sure, some have jobs lined up, and others are set to go to college. And that last group may have already plunked down their tuition deposits, the first real taste of what the college experience is going to cost.
Tuition at many colleges and universities is skyrocketing. We've talked about this on the program. People are doing the cost-benefit analysis and questioning what value students are really getting for all that money. There's also been a rise in online programs, for-profit universities, and other alternatives, so colleges find themselves going to great lengths to attract students.
Jeffrey Salingo is an editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education and also author of a new book, College Unbound. He worries that American higher education has in some ways lost its way, and one symptom is the resources many schools are spending on campus amenities.
You go into a dining hall now and you have sushi in the dining hall. You have climbing walls, which I think everybody has, but now you even have these lazy rivers where you could get in an inner tube and go down.
And read and study while you're floating
exactly.
along the river.
Well,
where is the pressure coming from on colleges to do this?
So college presidents say that students and parents want this. But my contention is that if Harvard tomorrow decided to knock down all its residence halls and essentially build jail cells, do you think people would stop coming to Harvard?
They'd probably keep going.
They'd probably keep going.
Okay, well, we're talking about schools that are building climbing walls at a time when a lot of schools are in a lot of debt and state funding for schools is going down. I mean, explain that for me.
Well, they did that in the last decade when enrollment was going up, when money was free-flowing. You know, most parents were using their homes as ATMs to pay for college because of the housing market. And now, suddenly, those bills are coming due. And the problem is that the students are either not there or they're unwilling to pay the money to fund those things.
Give me a specific example of kind of a school that is caught in this economic bind that you describe where it's hard to get out of.
Most small private liberal arts colleges in general. I mean, if you look at a map of the country, most of the private colleges in the U.S. are in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, and the Northeast, where all the population growth, especially of 18-year-olds, are in the South and Southwest.
Okay.
And so part of the problem is that they're having a hard time just attracting students because students have to fly halfway across the country to pay $50,000+ for a degree that they're not quite sure what they're going to do with.
You painted a picture of higher education and compared it to something like the auto industry in Detroit, that it's very resistant to change, but it's going to reach a point where it just has to accept that there's a new reality. If higher education goes through that process and emerges, what will be the same? What will be different?
I still think that colleges are still going to exist. Physical college campuses are still going to exist for those who want it. What will be different, however, is that you're going to have many more players now in the system. If you decide to take a MOOC, for example, and you want to transfer credit,
massive online courses,
open
right?
courses,
yeah.
right? So MOOCs might provide a piece of a person's education, this idea of competency-based education, which I think is perhaps the most disruptive force potentially entering higher education.
In this new world, you suggested that if you, Jeffrey Salingo, were looking for a job applicant and I was coming to you, I might be able to get some sort of credential from some online program that wasn't a college or university. But right. if you accept that as sort of a legitimate credential, you could hire me and kind of keep colleges out of the process.
Right. And I talked to some students who did that, who took some of these massively online open courses, and one of them is working for Google right now. I mean, the problem with that is that the best signal to the job market that you're ready still remains a college degree, and in my opinion will remain a college degree for the near future. But as employers are not satisfied with some of the college graduates that they're hiring, or they see others who are doing well based on their background, I think that we're going to start seeing employers look at alternative credentials, whether they're badges or certificates from other players beyond what we think of as traditional higher ed.
Well, what can colleges do to convince students who are sitting there and saying, I could take a massive online course. It's a lot cheaper than signing up for a full 4-year college degree. I mean, what's the value of paying all of this money and going to one of these campuses still?
Well, and the value is really the one-on-one interaction with professors. I don't believe that we're suddenly in 10 years going to see thousands of colleges go out of business and be replaced by online institutions. I'm also optimistic because some of the smartest, most innovative people in this country live and work on college campuses. And that's why I think we still can figure it out. But the problem is that we have to move away from this hubris that I think higher education now has. They feel like we're a public trust. People will always want to get us as they're getting us now. I think those days are over, and I think that colleges and universities need to think in new and different ways in order to prepare for the next 20, 30 years.
Jeffrey Salingo, he is the author of the new book, College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students.
Open up your email. On any given morning, you might get 2 or 3 notes from friends, 6 or 7 from people trying to sell you energy pills, offshore real estate, or virility enhancers. And the good news, you've just won the Lithuanian National Lottery, which you can't recall entering, or that a man in Kenya needs your help. Please, sir, only you can help to move $20 million through your bank account. All he needs is your routing number. That's spam. Not the meat-like loaf, but unbidden email, many of them not even sent by actual people, but robot programs, and their volume is often much greater than the amount of real information that people can find in their inboxes. Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet, is the title of a new book by Finn Brunton, who's now Assistant Professor of Information in the School of Information at the University of Michigan. He joins us from the studios of WUOM in Ann Arbor. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
First off, how did Pitcairn Island become the center for spam?
It's a marvelous story. Pitcairn Island, which is the least populated jurisdiction in the world, fascinated me because I was familiar with it only as an extremely minor historical event. It's where the bounty mutineers went when they needed to find an extremely remote place to hide.
Right.
And then
Mr.
I discovered...
Mr. Christian
yes,
wound
exactly.
up in Pitcairn Island, yeah.
Exactly. And I was shocked to learn that per capita, Pitcairn Island was the world's number one source of spam. And I was just wondering, as anyone would who encounters this statistic, how is this possible? And it's because of the fact that the people on Pitcairn, they don't realize that they have been made into part of the spam system. What has happened is that one of the computers on the island has been taken over by a malware program. So this island with 45 or 50 people is broadcasting spam without anyone consciously intending it.
Explain to us how it developed, because I have an idea. Let me try my pet theory on you, the academic expert, that the communications technologies expand as they become capable of delivering jokes.
Well, I think you are actually very close. The old rule of thumb in media history was that the first private use for any new major communications technology is pornography. But somewhere cheek by jowl with that is humor. One of my favorite details about the history of the telegraph is how quickly an incredible subculture of jokes and gags and pranks and references began to proliferate among the telegraph boys who were actually managing the equipment. But indeed, in the case of the internet, from very early on, when it was just these early, often somewhat ragged or haphazard networks between computers, mostly in academic settings, mm-hmm. the graduate students who were using these machines, as soon as they were not required to use them for some professional purpose, as soon as they had an off hour to kill in the basement, started using them to replay old Monty Python routines. Getting back to jokes. Yeah. And of course, one of the most famous Monty Python routines is the sort of spam chorus that the Vikings deliver in the made-up green midget cafe in that sketch where the couple is trying to order something from the menu and everything has spam in it.
What do you mean? I don't like spam!
Spam, 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 spam.
So it sort of starts off as a joke, but the term very quickly becomes the universal term for anyone who's doing that kind of annoying, jokey, time-wasting behavior on these very early computer networks.
Well, help us understand what robotics do.
When you get a spam message, sometimes it'll have an attachment. And the message will say something like, you know, it'll be a message from a friend. And it'll say like, oh, hey, could you take a look at this? And then you open it and it doesn't seem to do anything. It's just a bunch of weird symbols or it fails to open. And you assume, oh, something went wrong. I don't know. I'll just delete this and carry on with my day. When you've launched that, an exploit within the structure of the software that you're using has quietly taken over your computer. And it is using the computer's broadband connection to quietly, in the background, without your knowledge, begin sending out spam messages following the instructions of a central network called a command and control system. So what that means, if it costs you nothing to send 100 million messages and only some vanishingly small percentage of a percentage ever get through, well, just send 100 million more, you know? And if you can get another 2,000 or 3,000 actually through, you can still make a viable business out of it.
Well, help us understand the scale of that viable business.
You always had spammers who were just crooks, but then you had a lot of people who were moving business models in from the world of, for example, pharmaceutical advertisements in the back pages of weightlifting magazines. The people working now are out-and-out criminals, and that actually frees them up to potentially make a lot more money than they did before, because if they can convince you to buy something, it's no longer about actually selling you the pharmaceuticals. It's about taking your credit card information and then using that for identity theft purposes. And to be clear, spam email is upwards of 85 to 90% of all email sent on any given day. It's just that most of the time we don't see most of it because our filters are pretty good. But it's a tidal wave that's slamming into these walls that we've built day after day after day, and we see the little bit that slops over.
May I ask, how do you go through life knowing what you do?
I use what's called a password manager in my browser, and this is a system. It will automatically generate very, very long passwords for any new account you need to set up, and then it will keep track of all of them for you and log you in. Because the major danger here is not that someone will necessarily steal your computer. The major danger is an automatic system that, you know, breaks into Gawker's password store or what have you, and then begins to systematically search the internet for other things of yours that it can access using that particular arrangement of email and password. And having a good password manager makes that impossible.
Finn Brunton of the University of Michigan. His new book, Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Egg and spam? Egg, bacon and spam? Egg, bacon, sausage and spam? Spam, bacon, sausage and spam?
Spam. And you can learn about another of his recommended techniques for protecting yourself from spam by going to our website. To protect yourself from spam. Why not? NPR.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Gail Godwin has been a 3-time finalist for the National Book Award. In addition to her 12 novels, she's also published a 2-volume collection of her journals called The Making of a Writer. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Godwin's latest novel continues her fascination with female-centered households and wise children.
Gail Godwin says that one of the inspirations for her new novel, called Flora, is Henry James' ghost story, The Turn of the Screw. Both stories take place in isolated old houses, and both revolve around mental contests between a governess character and her young charge. There are ghosts in Flora, too, specters that arise out of what our narrator calls her remorse. Godwin had me at that word remorse. It's such a great old-fashioned word, and it suggests that there'll be a lot of awful things going on in this novel that will need to be atoned for. Our narrator here is named Helen Anstruther. Now in her 70s and a writer, Helen is looking back to the summer of 1945 when she was 10. Her mother has been dead for a long time, and her grandmother, who's been her main guardian, has just suffered a fatal heart attack while trying on Easter hats in the local department store. Helen's father, the principal of the high school in their North Carolina town, has decided to accept a summer job at the military plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Though nobody could know it yet, Helen's father will play his own small role in history by overseeing construction workers on the Manhattan Project. Homefront history, however, rather than military history, is Godwin's territory. And by homefront, I really mean that this story is restricted to Helen's house, perched atop a remote mountain. There, we readers are quarantined with Helen and her 22-year-old cousin Flora, who's come from Alabama to take care of her that summer. Because there's rumor raging of a polio epidemic in the area, the two girls are forbidden to go into town. Flora herself, as seen through Helen's eyes, is a totally unexpected type of character. She's simple-hearted. Helen goes on to tell us that Flora was the first older person I felt superior to. She was an instant crier. She possessed the gift of tears. As far as I could tell, layers had been left out of Flora. All of her seemed to be on the same level for anyone to see. You'd think that such a compassionate, uncomplicated young woman would be the perfect companion for a lonely girl who's lost so many loved ones in her short life. Think again. The profound wisdom that animates Godwin's novel is that simple-hearted people can sometimes be incredibly annoying. Helen, who's budding into a disdainful personality, finds herself increasingly vexed by Flora's cheerfully intrusive presence without exactly understanding why. Flora's habit of doing housework in bare feet, for instance, drives Helen crazy. She comments, "Flora's toenails turned up like they were making too much effort to be friendly." More readily understandable is Helen's anger over a skirt that Flora wears. It's made from one of Helen's mother's old dresses that's too small on top for the busty Flora. Helen recalls, "The awful truncated dress was the worst. The upper half of my mother cut away because Flora's bust line was way too big." Helen, who's more verbally adept than her older cousin, starts lashing out at her. But it's like punching the Pillsbury Doughboy. Flora just good-naturedly absorbs the shocks and bounces back. Even before that loaded word, remorse, pops up, you just know that things aren't going to turn out well, especially when an affable ex-serviceman turned grocery delivery man drives up one day and knocks on the door of that smoldering, solitary house. Children are like bombs that will one day go off. That's a line that Gail Godwin says also served as inspiration for her novel Flora. Godwin wrote the line in one of her journals, which she started keeping at the age of 12. Godwin is still writing in her journals and drawing upon them to explore the more out-of-the-way reaches of women's interior lives. Remorse may be the defining emotion for our narrator, Helen, but Godwin, the writer, has nothing to regret. Flora is an elegant little creeper of a story.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Flora by Gail Godwin.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Paul Rudnick is a writer in all kinds of media. He's a playwright, an essayist, and a humorist. He's written a lot for The New Yorker. And you've probably seen some of his popular films. He's written In and Out and The Addams Family Values. But now, Rudnick is dipping his toe into a new literary world, young adult fiction. His new book is called Gorgeous. It's a fairy tale, classic Cinderella format, except it starts in a trailer park with a girl named Becky.
Becky's mom dies, and she discovers a mysterious phone number, which she calls, and she receives a what will turn out to be a supernatural offer. She flies to New York, where she meets the legendary, reclusive fashion designer Tom Kelly. And Tom says, "I will make you three dresses, one red, one white, and one black. And if you wear these dresses, and if you do everything I say, you will become the most beautiful woman in the world. You will, in fact, become the most beautiful woman who has ever lived." So Becky gives her answer, and the rest of the book takes off like a skyrocket from there.
The voices in this book are diverse and funny. I mean, the dialogue between Becky, or Rebecca, and her best friend Roche? Am I saying that right?
It's Roche or Rocher, depending on what mood she's in. She's another girl from the trailer park who was named after the popular French chocolate, which her mother was, I think, quite in love with. So Becky, in fact, mentions that when Rocher is feeling a little bit good about herself, she becomes Roche. But for every day, it's Roche.
Don't we all? Yes.
Exactly. We all like a little accent over some part of our name.
Was it easy for you to capture the voice of teenage girls?
Shockingly easy, shamefully easy, I would even say. Because when I first had the idea for the actual storyline, I tried a lot of different approaches. I even wondered, was this a play or a movie or a book? And it wasn't until I began writing it in the voice of Becky herself, in the voice of an 18-year-old girl, that the story really flew. So I'm not quite sure what it says about me, but I had a blast.
What was your favorite magical detail or device that you wrote in this story?
I love the idea of endowing clothing and or high fashion with the power that we almost wish it had. That I think whenever anyone is getting dressed for the evening, especially if it's a Friday night or if it's an occasion or if it's a first date, that you're hoping that what you look like will elevate you. Your outfit and your shoes and your makeup and your hair will send the absolute perfect message to whoever you're about to meet, even if you don't know who that is. So I love taking that the final step of saying, okay, you're going to put on this dress and it's going to do everything you could ever hope for and beyond. So
it never works for me. It never works for me, Paul.
It can work until you leave the house sometimes. I think. Or what's shocking to me is every once in a while, if you see a photo, you know, whether it's something online on someone's phone, on someone's Facebook page, and you weren't aware that that photo was being taken, and you look okay or even better than that, and you could say, oh my God, I guess for at least a split second, I looked like that.
In many ways, this book is kind of a screwball comedy, much like many of your movies, your plays. What about this kind of style of writing, screwball comedy, is such a satisfying prism for you to see the world through? Is your life funny in that kind of odd way?
I hope it is. I think I come from a pretty funny family where humor was always sort of a very important balance wheel, especially when things went bad. Sometimes a joke was the only weapon you had. In fact, an early play I wrote called Jeffrey, people didn't imagine that this play would be possible because it was a comedy set during the AIDS crisis. But again, I saw people all around me who had such great senses of humor, and humor was the only thing that could get anyone through a situation like that. And beyond that, it's funny, I never sit down and say, okay, this is going to be comic, this will be a screwball romp. That's kind of what happens. That's just the way my brain is wired. And I guess I love the challenge of providing that particular breed of pleasure, that when I'm watching someone read one of my books on the subway, there's a few times that's happened, or when I'm in the back of a theater and the audience is watching a play or a movie, when they actually laugh, first, I'm incredibly grateful to the actors involved, but beyond that, it's such an enormous sort of gut satisfaction that I somehow can't imagine a writer gets from more serious work, although it's also, you know, deeply and sort of selfishly satisfying to make a reader cry. But when you say, yeah, that joke worked, or that character was funny, or that hit a comic nerve, it's a real high.
Do you remember the first time you saw someone on the subway reading something you had written?
I don't remember the exact moment, but it was years ago, and I wanted to fall to my knees. I wanted to write them a check. I wanted to photograph them. I wanted that photograph to be turned into a stamp. You know, I just couldn't believe it. I immediately assumed that a member of my family or a friend had paid them to do that. I then decided
and planted them in your line
exactly,
of vision.
Exactly. Or that if I looked too closely, they'd actually have hidden another book inside the cover of mine. But it was just, there was some sort of insane high that I got from it, because I think, oh my God, someone is actually reading the book. They seem fairly far along in it, so that they're going to finish it. They seem to be enjoying it. And my God, they paid for it. So it's just, I think it's every writer's secret fantasy.
Did you introduce yourself, or did you just let that be a private moment?
I let it be a private moment out of sheer paranoia, because I didn't want to say, oh, you know, you're reading my book, and have them say, eh.
Because you're in New York, you know.
Exactly. Or say, oh, yeah, somebody gave me this. I don't get it. But so I thought it was safer to let it keep the bubble aloft.
Paul Rudnick is the author of a new young adult novel. It's called Gorgeous. He joined us from our studio in New York. Paul, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Me too.